white her skin looked once the dirt was all washed off. The sight of her own brown legs and white belly surprised her so that she began to cry. Once the crying started, she couldn't stop it. She cried as if she would never stop. Gus noticed and walked over to help her out of the river, for she was just standing there sobbing, the water up to her thighs. Gus didn't reprimand her.
"I expect the best thing is for you to cry it out, Lori," he said. "You just remember, you got a long time to live."
"They shouldn't have took me," Lorena said when she stopped crying. She got her rag of a dress and went back to the tent.
Chapter 62.
Once they hit the territory, Newt began to worry about Indians. He was not alone in his worrying. The Irishman had heard so much about scalping that he often tugged at his own hair, as if to reassure himself that it wouldn't come off easily. P.I., who spent most of his time sharpening his knife or making sure he had enough ammunition, was astonished that the Irishman had never seen a scalped person. During P.'s years as a ranger, they were always finding scalped settlers, and, for that matter, several of his friends had been scalped. The Spettle boys, who were slowly becoming more talkative, confided in Newt that they would run away and go home if they weren't afraid of getting lost.
"But you have to drive the horses," Newt pointed out. "The captain hired you."
"Didn't know we was coming to where Indians were," Bill Spettle said. For all the talk, they saw neither Indians nor cowboys for days on end. They saw no one, just an occasional wolf or coyote. It seemed to Newt that the sky got bigger and the country emptier every day. There was nothing to see but grass and sky. The space was so empty that it was hard to imagine that there might ever be towns in it or people. The Irishman particularly found the huge emptiness disturbing.
"I guess we've left the people," he often said.
Or,
"When's the next people?"
Nobody was quite sure when to expect the next people.
"It's too bad Gus ain't here," P.I. said. "Gus'd know. He's an expert on where places is at."
"Why, there's nothing north of here," Dish said, surprised that anyone would think otherwise. "You have to go east a ways to get into the towns."
"I thought we were going to strike Ogallala," Needle reminded him.
"I don't say we won't," Dish said.
"That's up to the captain. But if it ain't no bigger than Dodge, wouldn't take much to miss it."
Poe Campo had become a great favorite with the men because of the tastiness of his cooking. He was friendly and kind to everyone, and yet, like the captain, he kept apart. Poe just did it in a different way. He might sing to them in his throaty voice, but he was a man of mystery, a strange man, walking all day behind the wagon, and at night whittling his little women. Soon, each of the cowboys had been given one of the carvings.
"To remind you of your sisters," Poe said.
A day and a half before they reached the Canadian, the rain started again. At the sight of the great gray clouds forming in the west, morale immediately sank and the men untied their slickers, resigned to a long, cold, dangerous night. A storm that struck them half a day from the Canadian was of a different intensity because of the lightning. By mid-afternoon, Newt, who was as usual with the drags, became conscious of rumblings and flashings far on the west. He saw Dietz conferring with the captain, though it was hard to imagine what advice might help. They were out in the middle of the plain, far from any shelter. All through the late afternoon, lightning flickered in the west. As the sun was setting, Newt saw something he had never seen. A bolt of lightning shot south to north, bisecting the setting sun. The bolt seemed to travel the whole length of the western horizon. The crack that came with it was so sharp that Newt almost expected to see the sun split in half, like a big red melon. After that bolt, the clouds rolled down on the group like a huge black herd, snuffing out the afterglow in 5 minutes. The remuda became restless, and Newt rode over to help Pete Spettle. But a bolt of lightning struck so close that his horse went into a violent fit of pitching and promptly threw him. He had kept a tight grip on the reins, and the horse didn't break free, but Newt had a time calming him enough that he could remount.
Claps of thunder were almost constant by then, and so loud that they made his head ring. The herd was stopped, the cowboys spread around it in as tight a ring as possible. Just as Newt mounted, a bolt of lightning struck the edge of the herd, not 100 feet from where the captain rode. A number of the cattle instantly fell, as if clubbed by the same club. It was as if a portion of a wall of cattle had broken and fallen to earth like so many bricks. A second later, the cattle were running. They broke west in a mass and surged through the riders as if they weren't there, although Dish, the captain, and Dietz were trying to turn them. The rain came almost as the cattle began to move. Newt spurred and tried to reach the head of the herd, which was nearer him than anyone. He saw a long line of lightning curl down and strike, but the cattle didn't stop. He heard the clicking of thousands of horns as the cattle bumped one another. Again, he saw the bluish light rolling on the tips of the cattle's horns, and was glad when the wall of rain came. He rushed to it with relief. Rain was just wet. It didn't scare him, and he knew that if it rained hard enough, the lightning would finally stop. The cattle ran for many miles, but soon the storm was to the east of them, and he had only the rain and darkness to contend with. As he had done before, he plodded along much of the night beside the cattle. Occasionally, he would hear the shout of another cowboy, but it was too dark and rainy to see anything. The length of such nights was a torment. 100 times, or 1,000, he would look in what he thought was an easterly direction, hoping to see the grayness that meant dawn. But all directions were equally black for what seemed like 20 hours. When dawn did come, it was a low and gloomy one, the sky heavily overcast. Newt, with Dish, the Irishman, Needle Nelson, was with a large portion of the herd, perhaps 1,000 cattle. No one was quite sure where the rest of the herd was. The cattle were too tired to be troublesome, so Dish loped off to look and was gone what seemed like 30 minutes. When he finally came back, Dietz was with him. The main herd was 6 or 7 miles east. "How many did the lightning hit?" Newt asked, remembering the sight of the cattle falling dead. 13, Dish said. "That ain't the worst of it, though. Killed Bill Spittle. Knocked him right off his horse. They're burying him now." Newt had been feeling very hungry, but the news took his appetite. He had been chatting with Bill Spittle not 2 hours before the storm began. Bill was beginning to be rather talkative after hundreds of miles of silence. "They say it turned him black," Dish remarked. "I didn't see it." Newt was never to see where Bill Spittle was buried. When they rejoined the main herd, it was on the move, the grave somewhere behind on the muddy plain. No one knew quite what to say to Pete Spittle, who had somehow held the remuda together all night. He was holding it together still, though he looked weary and stunned. The men were all starving, so Call allowed them to stop for a quick feed, but only a quick one. It was looking like rain again. He knew the Canadian was near, and he wanted to cross it before more rains came. Otherwise, they might be trapped for a week. "Ain't we gonna rest?" Jasper asked, appalled that they were required to keep driving after such a night. "We'll rest north of the river," Call said. Dietz had been sent to find a crossing, but came back almost before he had left. The Canadian was only 4 miles away, and there was a crossing that had obviously been used by many herds. "We all gonna have to swim," he said, to Jasper's consternation. "I just hope we don't have to swim in a darn rainstorm," Dish said, looking at the heavy clouds. "I don't see what difference it makes," Needle said. "It can get just so wet. If you're swimming, you're bound to be wet." "It ought to quit raining. It's rained enough," P.I. said. But the heavens ignored him. Call was more worried than he let on. They had already lost a boy that day, another boy hastily buried who would never see his home again. He had no wish to risk any more, and yet the river had to be crossed. He loped up to look at the crossing and satisfied himself that it was safe. The river was high, but it wasn't a wide river. They wouldn't need to swim far. He rode back to the herd. Many of the men had changed into their dry clothes while he was gone, a wasteful effort with the river coming up.
"Yeah, you best strip off when we get to the river, or you'll just get them clothes wet too," Call said. "Wrap your clothes up good in your slicker so you'll have something dry to put on when we get across."
"Ride naked?" Jasper asked, shocked that such a thing would be required of him. Northern travel was proving even worse than he had thought it would be. Bill Spettle had been so stiffened when they found him that they had not been able to straighten him out properly. They had just wrapped him in a bedroll and stuck him in a hole.
"Well, I'd rather be naked a spell than have to travel in wet duds like we done all last night," P.I. said.
When they approached the river, the herd was held up so the men could strip off. It was so chilly that Newt got goosebumps all over his body when he undressed. He wrapped his clothes and tied them high on his saddle, even his boots. The sight of all the men riding naked would have been amusing if he hadn't been so tired and nervous about the crossing. Everyone looked white as a fish belly, except their hands and faces, which were brown.
"Good Lord, we're a bunch of beauties," Dish said, surveying the crew. "Dietz is the best looking of the lot. At least he's one color. The rest of us is kind of brindled."
Nobody expected weather conditions to get worse, but it seemed that in plains weather there was always room for surprises. A squall blew up as they were starting the cattle into the water, and by the time Old Dog was across the 20 yards of swimming water, Dish on one side of him and Call on the other, the gray skies suddenly began to spit out little white pellets. Dish, who was out of the saddle, hanging onto his saddle strings as his horse swam, saw the first pellets plunking into the water and jerked with fear, for he assumed they were bullets. It was only when he looked up and had a small hailstone peck at his cheek that he realized what was happening. Call, too, saw the hail begin to pepper the river. At first, the stones were small, and he wasn't too worried, for he had seen fleeting hail squalls pass in 5 minutes. By the time he and Dish hit the north shore and regained their wet saddles, he realized that it was more than a squall. Hailstones were hitting all around him, bouncing off his arms, his saddle, his horse, and they were getting larger by the minute. Dish came riding over, still naked, trying to shelter his face and head with one arm. Hailstones were falling everywhere, splashing into the river, bouncing off the backs of the cattle and plunking into the muddy banks.
"What'll we do, Cap'n?" Dish asked. "They're getting bigger. Reckon they'll beat us to death?"
Call had never heard of anyone being killed by hailstones, but he had just taken a hard crack behind the ear from a stone the size of a pullet egg. Yet they couldn't stop. Two of the boys were in the river, swimming, and the cattle were still crossing.
"Get under your horse if it gets worse," he said. "Use your saddle for cover." "This horse would kick me to death if I was to try that," Dish said.
He quickly unsaddled and used his saddle blanket for immediate shelter. Newt didn't know what was happening when the first hailstones hit. When he saw the tiny white pellets bouncing off the grass, he assumed he was at last seeing snow.
"Look, it's snowing," he said excitedly to Needle Nelson, who was near him.
"It ain't snow, it's hail," Needle said.
"I thought snow was white," Newt said, disappointed.
"They're both white," Needle said. "The difference is hail is harder."
Within a few minutes, Newt was to find out just how hard. The sky began to rain balls of ice, small at first, but then not so small.
"By God, we better get in that river," Needle said.
He had a large hat and was trying to hide under it, but the hailstones pounded his body. Newt looked around for the wagon, but couldn't see it. The hail was so thick. Then he couldn't see Needle either. He spurred hard and raced for the river, though he didn't know what he was supposed to do once he got there. As he ran for the river, he almost trampled Jasper, who had dismounted and made kind of a tent of a slicker and saddle. He was crouching under it in the mud. It was hailing so thickly that when they did reach the river, Mouse jumped off a 6-foot bank, throwing Newt. Again, he managed to hang on to his reins, but he was naked and the hailstones were pounding all around him. When he stood up, he happened to notice that Mouse made kind of a wall. By crouching close under him, Newt avoided most of the hailstones. Mouse absorbed them. Mouse wasn't happy about it, but since he had taken it upon himself to jump off the bank, Newt didn't feel very sorry for him. He crouched under the horse until the hailstorm subsided, which was not more than 10 minutes after it began. The muddy banks of the Canadian were covered with hailstones. So were the plains all around them. The cattle and horses crunched through the hail as they walked. Isolated stones continued to plop down now and then, bouncing off the ones already there. Newt saw that the cattle had crossed the wild Canadian, the river that had scared everybody, without much help from the cowboys who were scattered here and there, naked, crouched under their saddles, or, in some cases, their horses. It was a funny sight. Newt was so glad to be alive that suddenly he felt like laughing. Funniest of all was P.I., who stood not 30 yards away, up to his neck in the river, with his hat on. He was just standing there calmly, waiting for the hail to stop. "How come you're in the water?" Newt asked when P.I. waded out. "It's fine protection," P.I. said. "It can't hail through water." It was amazing to Newt to see the plains, which had been mostly brown a few minutes before, turn mostly white. The Irishman walked up, leading his horse and kicking hailstones out of the way. He began to pick up the hailstones, throw them in the river. Soon several of the cowboys were doing it, seeing who could throw the farthest or make the hailstones skip across the water. Then they saw a strange sight. Pocampo was gathering hailstones in a bucket, the two pigs following him like dogs. "What do you reckon he expects to do with them?" Needle Nelson asked. "I guess he'll stew 'em, probably," P said. "He's looking them over like he's picking peas." "I wouldn't want to see this outfit naked tomorrow," Jasper said. "I guess we'll all be black and blue. One hit me on the elbow, and I can't straighten my arm yet." "You don't do much with it when you do straighten it," Bert remarked unsympathetically. "Just 'cause he can't rope like you don't mean he wouldn't like to use his arm," P.I. said. Everyone picked on Jasper, and once in a while P. felt obliged to come to his defense. He swung onto his horse and froze before getting his other foot in the stirrup. He had happened to glance across the river and had spotted a horseman riding toward them. The crew on the north bank had their backs to the rider and hadn't seen him. "Why, I swear, it's Gus," P.I. said. "He ain't dead at all." They all looked and saw the rider coming. "How do you know it's him?" Bert wanted to know. "He's too far. Could be an Indian chief for all you know." "I guess I know Gus," P.I. said. "I wonder where he's been."
Chapter 63.
Call and Dish were just getting into their dry pants when Augustus came riding up. It was not until they heard the sound of his horse crushing the hailstones that they turned around. Call saw at once that Gus was riding a different horse from the one on which he had ridden off, but he himself looked fit.
"I, God, I never thought you boys would start working naked," Augustus said. "I guess the minute I left camp, things went right to hell. You jaybirds look like you're scattered from here to Fort Worth."
"Well, a river was deep, and we ain't overloaded with dry clothes," Call said. "What happened to you?"
"Nothing much," Augustus said. "I got here last week and decided there wasn't no sense in riding south. I'd just have to turn around and come back."
"Did you ever find Lori?" Dish asked.
"Oh, sure," Augustus said. "I found her. She's probably sitting out in front of the tent right now watching you prance around naked."
At that, Dish blushed and made haste to get the rest of his clothes on, though when Gus pointed out the tent to him, he saw it was too far away for Lori to have seen anything. At that point, several of the naked cowboys on the south bank plunged into the river and swam over, so excited by Gus's return that they forgot caution.
"I swear, Gus, we near give you up," P.I. said. "Did you catch the bandit?" "No, but I hope I do someday," Augustus said. "I met plenty of his friends, but he slipped by me."
"Did you get to town or what?" Dish asked. "You didn't have no tent when you rode off."
"Mr. Wheelbarger loaned me that tent," Augustus said. "Laura's feeling shy and she needs a little privacy." We best get the wagons across, Carl said. We can listen to Gus's story later. You boys that ain't dressed, go back and help.
The sun came out, and that, plus Gus's arrival, put the hands in a high mood. Even Jasper, normally so worried about rivers, forgot his fear and swam right back across the Canadian to help get the wagon. They all treated swimming the river like a frolic, though they had been anxious about it for a week. Before long, they had the wagon across. They had put both pigs in it, but the blue shoat jumped out and swam across.
That's an independent pig, Augustus said. I see you still got that old cook.
Yes, his food's right tasty, Carl said. Is the girl all right?
She's had an ordeal, but she's young, Augustus said. She won't forget it, but she might outlive it.
We're a long way from any place we could leave her, Carl said.
No, I have no intention of leaving her, Augustus said. We've got Will Barger's tent. We'll go along with you cowboys till we hit Nebraska.
Then what? Carl asked.
I don't know. We ain't there yet, Augustus said. What's the word on Jake?
He was in Fort Worth when we passed by, Carl said. I guess he's mainly card playing.
I met the sheriff that's after him, Augustus said. He's ahead of us somewhere. His wife run off and Blue Duck killed his deputy and two youngsters who were traveling with him. He's got other things on his mind besides Jake.
Yeah, he's welcome to Jake if he wants him, Carl said. I won't defend a man who lets a woman get stolen and just goes back to his cards.
It was wisdom, Augustus said. Blue Duck would have scattered Jake over two counties if he'd run into him.
I call it cowardice, Carl said. Why didn't you kill Blue Duck?
He's quick, Augustus said. Couldn't follow him on this piece of soap I'm riding. Anyway, I had Lori to consider.
I hate to let a man like that get away, Carl said.
Go get him, Woodrow, Augustus said. He's west of here, probably in Colorado. You go get him, and I'll nurse these cows along till you get back. Now, what's that old cook doing?
They saw all the cowboys gathered around the wagon, which was still dripping from its passage through the river.
He likes to surprise the boys, Carl said. He's always coming up with something different.
They trotted over and saw that Pocampo had made the hailstones into a kind of candy with the use of a little molasses. He dipped them in molasses and gave each of the hands one to lick.
Well, senor, he said to Augustus, I see you made it back in time for dessert.
I made it back in time to see a bunch of naked waddies cross a river, Augustus said. I thought you'd all turned Indian and was aiming to scalp Jasper. Where's young Bill Spittle? Is he gone into hiding?
There was an awkward silence. Lippy, sitting on the wagon seat, stopped licking the hailstone that he had been giving.
No, senor. He is buried, Pocampo said. A victim of lightning.
Yeah, that's a pity, Augustus said. He was young and had promise.
It killed 13 head with one bolt, P.I. said. You never seen such lightning, Gus.
I seen it, Augustus said. We had a little weather, too.
Newt felt warm and happy, his clothes on, and Mr. Gus back with the crew. The sky had cleared, and the clouds that had caused the terrible hail were only a few wisps on the eastern horizon. In the bright sun, with the river crossed and the cattle grazing on the wet grass, and Lorena rescued, life seemed like a fine thing, though every once in a while he would remember Bill Spittle, buried in the mud a few miles back, or Sean O'Brien, way down on the Nueces. The warm sun and bright air had brought them no pleasure. Pocampo had given him a hailstone dipped in molasses, and he sat licking it and feeling alternately happy and sad while the men got dressed and prepared to be cowboys again.
Are there any more trees, or does this plain just go on to Canada?
Bert Borum asked.
I wouldn't bet on trees for the next few months, Augustus said.
The men wondered about Lorena.
Many still held her beauty in their minds. What had happened to her? What did she look like now? Hers was the most beauty many of them had seen, and now that she was near, it shone fresh in memory and made them all more anxious to see her. Dish, especially, could not keep his eyes off the little tent. He longed for a glimpse of her and kept imagining that any minute she would step out of the tent and look his way. Surely she remembered him. Perhaps she would even wave and call him over. Lorena knew the cowboys were near, but she didn't look out of the tent. Gus had assured her that he would be back soon, and she trusted him. Though sometimes when he was gone for an hour looking for game, she still got the shakes. Blue Duck wasn't dead. He might come back and get her again, if Gus didn't watch close. She remembered his face and the way he smiled when he kicked her. Gus was the only thing that kept the memories away, and sometimes they were so fresh and frightening that she wished that she had died so her brain could stop working and just leave her in the quiet. But her brain wouldn't stop. Only Gus could distract it with talk and card games. Only his presence relaxed her enough that she could sleep. Now and then she peeped out and saw the wagon, with Gus standing by it. He was easy to spot because of his white hair. As long as she could spot him, she didn't feel worried. Call let the men camp. They had had a rough 24 hours. A big steer had crippled itself crossing the river. Bert roped it, and Pocampo killed it efficiently with a sharp blow of an axe. He butchered it just as efficiently and soon had beefsteaks cooking. The smell reminded the men that they were famished. They went at the meat like wolves.
"A cow don't go far with this bunch," Augustus observed. "You boys don't learn to curb your appetites, you'll have eaten the whole darn herd before we strike the Powder River. It'll be a big joke on you, Carl," he added.
"What will?" Carl asked. His mind had been on Blue Duck.
"Think of it," Augustus said. "You start off to Montana with a bunch of cattle and some hungry hands. By the time you get there, the hands will have et the cattle and you're back at nothing. Then the Cheyenne or the Sioux will wipe out the hands, and that'll leave you."
"What about yourself?" Carl asked. "You're along."
"I'll have stopped and got married, probably," Augustus said. "It's time I started my family."
"Are you marrying Lori then, Gus?" Dish asked in a sudden panic. He was aware that Gus had saved Lorena from a bad fate and supposed that she might be going to marry him in gratitude.
"No, Dish. I've someone else in mind," Augustus said. "Don't run your hopes up no flagpole, though. Laura's apt to be skittish of men for the next few years."
"Hell, she always was," Needle observed. "I offered her good money twice, and she looked right through me like I was a glass window or something."
"Well, you're skinny," Augustus said. "Plus you're too tall to suit a woman. Women would rather have runts on the whole."
The remark struck the company as odd. Why would women rather have runts? And how did Gus know such a thing? But then it was a comforting remark, too, for it was like Gus to say something none of them expected to hear. Those that had night guard would be able to amuse themselves with the remark for hours, considering the pros and cons of it and debating among themselves whether it could be true.
"Darn, I missed listening to you, Gus," P.I. said as Augustus was mounting to leave.
Call rode a little way out of camp with Augustus. A flock of cranes came in and settled on the banks of the river.
"This trip is hard on boys," Augustus said. "We've lost two already, and young sheriff lost a boy and a girl."
They stopped for a smoke. In the distance, the night guard was just going out to the herd.
"We should have stayed lawmen and left these boys at home," Augustus said. "Half of them will get drowned or hit by lightning before we get to Montana. We should have just gone ourselves and found some rough old town and civilized it. That's the way to make a reputation these days."
"I don't want a reputation," Carl said. "I've had enough outlaws shoot at me. I'd rather have a ranch."
"Well, I got to admit, I still like a fight," Augustus said. "They sharpen your wits. The only other thing that does that is talking to women, which is usually more dangerous."
"Now you've ended up the caretaker of that girl," Carl said. "She ain't the woman you're after."
No, she ain't, Augustus said. He had been pondering that point himself. Of course, for all he knew, Clara was still a happily married woman, and all his thinking about her no more than idle daydreams. He had long wanted to marry her, and yet life was continually slipping other women between her and him. It had happened with his wives earlier.
"I wish you'd been married," he said to Call.
"Why?" Call asked.
"I'd like your thoughts on the subject, that's why," Augustus said. "Only you ain't got no experience, so you can't be no help."
"Well, I never come close," Call said. "I don't know why."
"No interest," Augustus said. "Also, you ain't never figured yourself out. You don't like to take chances."
"I could argue that," Call said. "I've taken my share of chances, I guess."
"In battle, but not in love," Augustus said. "Unless you want to call what you done to Maggie taking a chance."
"Why do you always want to talk about that?" Call said.
"Because it was as close as you ever came to doing something normal. It's all I've got to work with. Here you brought these cattle all this way, with all this inconvenience to me and everybody else. And you don't have no reason in this world to be doing it."
Call didn't answer. He sat smoking. The Irishman had begun to sing to the herd. "Since you know so much about me, have you got any suggestions?" he asked.
"Certainly have," Augustus said. "Take these cattle over to the nearest town and sell them. Pay off whatever boys are still alive."
"And then what?"
"I go deal with the ladies for a while," Augustus said. "You take P and Dietz and ride up the Purgatory River until you find Blue Duck. Then either you'll kill him or he'll kill all of you."
"What about the boy?" Call asked.
"Newt can go with me and learn to be a ladies' man," Augustus said. "You won't claim him anyway. And the last boy that got near Blue Duck has his head smashed in with a rifle butt."
"Nope," Call said. "I'm primed to see Montana. If we're the first ones there, we can take our pick of the land."
"You can take your pick," Augustus said. "I'm in the mood to travel. Once you boys get settled, I may go to China, for all you know."
And with that, he rode off. Call smoked a while, feeling odd and a little sad. Jake had proved a coward and would never be part of the old crew again. Of course, he hadn't been for 10 years. The old crew was mostly a memory, though P and Dietz were still there, and Gus, in a strange way. But it was all changing. He saw the girl come out of the tent when Gus dismounted. She was just a shape in the twilight. Gus said that she wouldn't talk much, not even to him. Call didn't intend to try her. He loped a mile or two to the west and put the mare on her lead rope. The sky overhead was still light, and there was a little fingernail moon.
Chapter 64.
Jake spent most of his days in a place called Bill's Saloon, a little clapboard place on the Trinity River Bluffs. It was a two-story building. The whores took the top story, and the gamblers and cowboys used the bottom. From the top floor, there were usually cattle in sight trailing north, small herds and large. Once in a while, a foreman came in for liquor and met Jake. When they found out that he had been north to Montana, some tried to hire him, but Jake just laughed at them. The week after he had left the Hat Creek herd had been a good week. He couldn't draw a bad card, and by the time the week was over, he had a stake enough to last him a month or two. "I believe I'll just stay," he told the foreman. "I like the view." He also liked a long-legged whore named Sally Skull. At least that was what she called herself. She ran the whoring establishment for Bill Sloan, who owned the saloon. There were 5 girls, but only 3 rooms. And with the herds coming through in such numbers, the cowboys were in the place practically all the time. Sally had alarm clocks outside the rooms. She gave each man 20 minutes, after which the big alarm clocks went off with a sound like a fire bell. When that happened, Sally would throw the door open and watch while the cowboys got dressed. Sally was skinny but tall, with short black hair.
She was taller than all but a few of the cowboys, and the sight of her standing there unnerved most of the men so much that they could hardly button their buttons. The majority of them were just boys, anyway, and not used to whorehouse customs and alarm clocks. One or two of the bolder ones complained, but Sally was unimpressed and uncompromising. "If you can't squirt your squirt in 20 minutes, you need a doctor, not a whore," she said. Sally drank hard from the time she woke up until the time she passed out. She kept one of the three rooms for her own exclusive use, the one with a little porch off it. When Jake got tired of card playing, he would come and sit with his feet propped up on the porch rail and watch wagons move up and down the streets of Fort Worth. Once Sally had the alarm clock set, she would come in for a few minutes herself with a whiskey glass and help him watch. He had hit it off with her at once, and she let him sleep in her bed. But the bed and the privileges that went with it cost him $10 a day, a sum he readily agreed to since he was on a winning streak. Once he had got his first $10 worth, he felt free to discuss the arrangements. "What if we don't do nothing but sleep?" he asked. "Is it still $10? "Yep," Sally said. "I can buy a darn bed for the night a sight cheaper than that," Jake pointed out. "If it's got me in it, it ain't just a bed," Sally said. "Besides, you get to sit on the balcony all you want to, unless one of my good sweethearts is in town." It turned out that Sally Skull had quite a number of good sweethearts, some of them so rank that Jake didn't see how she could stand them. She didn't mind mule skinners or buffalo hunters. In fact, she seemed to prefer them. "Hell, I'm the only one of your customers that's taken a bath this year," Jake complained. "You could take up with bankers and lawyers, and the sheets wouldn't stink so." "I like 'em muddy and bloody," Sally said. "I ain't nice. This ain't a nice place. And it ain't a nice life. I'd take a hog to bed if I could find one that walked on two legs." Jake had seen hogs that kept cleaner than some of the men Sally Skull took upstairs, but something about her raw behavior stirred him, and he stayed with her and paid the daily $10. The cowboys that came through were very poor card players, so he could usually make his fee back in an hour. He tried other whores and other saloons, skinny ones and fat ones, but with them a time came when he would remember Lorena and immediately lose interest. Lorena was the most beautiful woman he had ever known, and her beauty grew in his memory. He thought of her often with a pang, but also with anger, for in his view it was entirely her own fault that she had been stolen. Whatever was happening to her, it was her punishment for stubbornness. She could easily have been living with him in a decent hotel in Austin or Fort Worth. Sally Skull had bad teeth and a thin body with no particular beauties. Her long legs were skinny as a bird's, and she had nothing that could match Lorena's fine bosom. If anyone said a wrong word to her, they got a tongue lashing that would make the coarsest man blush. If one of her girls got too sweet on a cowboy, which could always happen in her profession, Sally promptly got rid of her, shoving her out the back door of the saloon into the dusty street. "Don't get in love around me," she would say. "Go do it in the alley if you want to give it away." Once she fired three girls in one day for lazing around with the boys. For the next week, she serviced most of the customers herself. Jake decided he was crazy for taking up with Sally. She lived too raw for him. Besides the drinking and the men, she also took powders of various kinds, which she bought from a druggist. She would take the powders and lay beside him wide-eyed, not saying a word for hours. Still, he would be awakened at dawn when she pulled the cork out of the whiskey bottle she kept by the bed. After a few swigs to wake herself up, she would always want him, no matter that she had serviced 20 cowboys the night before. Sally flared with the first light. He couldn't think what he liked about her, yet he couldn't deny her either. She made $100 a day or more, but spent most of it on her powders or on dresses, most of which she wore only once or twice. When the Hat Creek outfit passed through, some of the men came in and said hello to Jake, but he froze them out.
It was their fault that Lorena was lost, and he had no more use for them. But tales about him were told, and they soon got back to Sally's Gull. "Why'd you let that Indian get your horse?" she asked him bluntly. "He was a tricky bandit," Jake said. "For all I know, she may have liked him. She never liked me much." Sally's Gull had green eyes, which dilated when she took her powders. She looked at him like a mean cat that was about to pounce on a lizard. Though it was barely sunup, they had already been at it. The grimy sheets were a puddle of sweat. "She never would mind," Jake said, wishing the Hat Creek outfit had kept their mouth shut. "I wouldn't mind you either, Jake," Sally said. "I wish I could trade places with her." "You what?" he asked, mightily startled. "I went with a nigger, but never an Indian," she said. "I'd like to try one." The news about the nigger was a shock to Jake. He knew Sally was wild, but hadn't supposed she was that wild. The look on her face frightened him a little. "You know something else? I paid that nigger," she said. "I gave him $10 to turn whore, and then he never got to spend it." "Why not?" Jake asked. "He bragged, and they hung him from a tree," Sally said. "The wrong thing to brag about in Georgia. Some of them wanted to hang me, but they didn't have the guts to hang a woman. I just got run out of town." That night there was trouble. A young foreman gave Sally some lip when she tried to rush him off, and she shot him in the shoulder with a derringer she kept under her pillow. He wasn't hurt much, but he complained, and the sheriff took Sally to jail and kept her. Jake tried to bail her out, but the sheriff wouldn't take his money. "Leave her sit," he said. Only Sally did more than sit. She bribed one of the deputies into bringing her some powders. She looked a mess, but somehow it was the mess about her that men couldn't resist. Jake couldn't himself. Somehow she could bring him to it despite her teeth and her oniony smells and the rest. She brought the deputy to it, too, and then tried to grab his gun and break jail. Although if she had waited, the sheriff would have let her out in a day or two. Somehow, in fighting over the one gun, she and the deputy managed to shoot each other fatally. They died together on the cell floor in a pool of blood, both half-naked. The deputy had 9 children, and his death caused an uproar against whores and gamblers. So much that Jake thought it prudent to leave town. He searched Sally's room before he left and found $600 in a hat box. Since Sally was dead and buried, he took it. The whores who were left were so scared they hired a buggy and came with him over to Dallas, where they soon found work in another saloon. In Dallas, Jake won some money from a soldier who reported that he had met a deputy sheriff from Arkansas. The deputy was looking for the sheriff, and the sheriff was looking for a man who had killed his brother. The soldier had forgotten all the names, and Jake didn't mention that he was the man being sought. The information made him nervous, though. The sheriff from Arkansas was evidently in Texas somewhere and might show up any time. While he was pondering what his next move might be, a hard-looking crew showed up in the saloon where he was playing. It consisted of 3 brothers, the Suggs brothers. Dan Suggs was the oldest and most talkative. The younger two, Ed and Roy, were sullen and restless, always watching the doors to see who might be coming in. Dan had no interest in doors, or any apparent concern other than a need to have his whiskey glass filled rather often. All 3 were scraggly bearded men. "Didn't you, Ranger?" Dan asked, when he heard Jake's name. "I rangered some," Jake said. "You run with Colin McCrae, didn't you?" Dan said. "I never met Call or McCrae, but I've heard they're hard men." It irked Jake a little that those two had such reputations. It seemed to him that he had done about as much as they had in the rangering days. After all, he was the man who had shot one of the most famous bandits on the border. While they talked and played cards a little, Roy Suggs kept spitting tobacco on the barroom floor. It irked Ralph, the man who owned the bar. He brought over a spittoon and put it by Roy's chair, but Roy Suggs looked at him with a cold eye and continued to spit on the floor. "Roy will spit where he pleases," Dan said with a mean grin. "Spoon, how'd you like to be a regulator?" he asked a little later. I recall from stories I've heard that you can shoot a gun.
What is a regulator? Jake asked. I've not heard the term.
Folks up in Kansas are getting tired of these Texas cattle tramping in constantly, Dan said. They want this trail-driving business regulated.
Regulated how?
Well, taxed, Dan said. People can't go on driving cattle just anywhere. If they want to cross certain rivers at certain crossings, they've got to pay for the privilege. If they won't pay in cash, then they've got to pay in cattle.
Is it the law in Kansas, or what? Jake asked.
It ain't, but some folks think it ought to be, Dan said.
Us folks, mainly, Roy said, spitting.
I see, Jake said. If Carl and Gus try to take some cattle across one of them rivers you're regulating, then you stop them and tell them that they have to pay. Is that how the scheme works?
That's it, Dan said.
I'd like to see you tell Woodrow Carl he has to pay you money to drive cattle across a river, Jake said. I ain't a friend of the man. He's recently treated me poorly, but unless there's a law and you can show it to him, he won't be collecting no double eagles.
Then he'll have to suffer the consequences, Dan said.
Jake laughed. The consequences of that would be that somebody would have to dig your grave, he said. If Carl didn't shoot you, Gus would. They ain't used to taking orders from you regulators.
By God, then they'll learn, Roy Suggs said.
Maybe, but you won't teach him, Jake said. You'd be sitting dead in your saddle if you tried it. Though he was annoyed with Carl and Gus, it amused him that three scraggly bandits thought they could beat them. Dan Suggs was not pleased with their conversation either.
I thought you might be a man with some gumption, he said. I see I was wrong.
I can supply enough gumption, Jake said, but I don't ride with inexperienced men. If you think you can ride up to Carl and McCrae and collect money from them with a few threats, then you're too inexperienced for me.
Dan was silent for a bit.
Well, they're just one bunch, he said. There are plenty of other herds on the trail.
That's right, Jake said.
If I was you, I'd try to regulate some of the ones that ain't been led by Texas Rangers. Roy and Ed looked at him hostily. They didn't like hearing it suggested that they weren't up to the job. But Dan Suggs was a cooler man. After they'd played some cards and worked through a bottle of whiskey, he admitted that the regulating scheme was something he'd just thought up.
My notion was that most cowboys can't fight, Dan said.
Hell, they're just boys. Them settlers up there can't fight, neither. A lot of them might pay us to keep the beeves out of their corn patches.
They might, but it sounds like you're speculating, Jake said. Before I leave this here easy life to go and get shot at, I'd like a little better prospect to think about.
How about robbing banks if the regulating don't work out? Dan asked bluntly.
You got any objections to robbing banks?
It would depend on the bank, Jake said. I wouldn't enjoy it if there was too much law stacked up against me.
I'd think you'd want to pick small towns.
They talked for several hours, Roy Suggs resolutely spitting tobacco on the floor. Dan Suggs pointed out that all the money seemed to be in Kansas. If they went up there and weren't too particular about what they did, they ought to be able to latch on to some of it. Jake found the Suggs brothers unattractive. They all had cold, mean eyes, and no great affection even for one another. Roy and Ed almost got into a gunfight over a hand of cards. He offered to get them whores, for he had stayed friendly with several of the girls who had come over from Fort Worth, but the Suggs brothers weren't interested. Drinking and card playing appealed to them more. Had it not been for the threat of July Johnson somewhere around, he would have let the Suggs brothers head for Kansas without him. He was comfortable where he was and had no appetite for hard riding and gunfighting. But Dallas wasn't far from Fort Smith, and July Johnson might arrive any time. That was an uncomfortable thought, so uncomfortable that 3 days later Jake found himself riding north with the three Suggs boys and a tall black man they called Frog Lip. Jake equipped himself with a new rifle before they left. He had made the Suggs brothers no promises, and as soon as he found a nice saloon in Kansas, he meant to let them go their way.
Froglip owned 5 guns of various calibers. He spent most of his time cleaning them. He was a fine marksman. The first day out, he brought down a deer at a distance Jake would have considered impossible. Froglip seemed to take the shot for granted. Jake had the strong feeling that the black man's guns would soon be pointed at something besides deer, but he himself didn't plan to be around to see it.
Chapter 65.
July rode for days without seeing any person, or, for that matter, any signs of life except the hawks and buzzards circling in the blue prairie sky. Once he saw a wolf loping along a ridge, and at night he heard coyotes, but the only game he saw were jackrabbits, and it was mostly rabbit he ate. He kept going north, reminding himself that it was a long way to any towns, but soon the unvarying emptiness of the country began to disturb him, and he was already disturbed enough by the deaths of the 3 people buried on the Canadian. He thought of them more or less all day, walking in the gray dawn. He would have Roscoe's face in his mind when he dreamed. It was of Roscoe and Joe and the young girl. Several times he cried at the thought of the finality of it. He had a longing to get them back in places they belonged, Fort Smith in the case of Roscoe and Joe. He didn't know where the girl had belonged, though it wasn't in a grave on the Canadian. What he was doing, indeed, his whole life, now seemed to him completely futile. He rode through the empty land without hope of anything, simply going on because he had to do something. As he went further and further into the plains, he ceased to be able to imagine Fort Smith as a place where he might ever live and work again. What would he do if he did go back? Sit in the jail where he had worked with Roscoe, or in the cabin where he had lived with Elmira? July didn't see how things could get worse since he had lost his wife and led 3 people to their deaths. But 4 days after he left Augustus, his horse went lame. Some spiky cactus hidden by the tall prairie grass proved more deadly than a snake. A thorn worked its way far up into the horse's hoof. July had to tie the horse down to get the thorn out, and even then was not sure he had got it all. They were 3 days north of the Cimarron when it happened. Water was scarce, and the horse soon too lame to ride. He led the horse, taking it slow, hoping the hoof would get better, but it did no good. The horse was lamed and could put no weight on the hoof at all. Finally, sadly feeling that he was parting with his last companion in life, July unsaddled the horse and shot him. He left his saddle but took his rifle and started walking east. The next day, from a ridge, he saw a great cloud of buzzards over the place where the horse lay. The sight made him cry. He walked all day, hoping to cross a creek, but finding none. He had a half canteen of water, not enough to get him back to the Cimarron. And he had nothing to eat. He made a dry camp and sat all night on his blanket. So wakeful, he thought he would never sleep again. He sat for hours, watching the moon climb high amid the bright stars. He remembered the cold nights in their Arkansas cabin when he was a boy, how his mother piled quilts on top of him and his brothers, how peaceful it seemed under the quilts. Then it seemed like sleep was one of the most wonderful things in life. July wondered if perhaps the sleep of death would be as good, as comforting and warming as his boyhood slumber. He had a rifle and a pistol. One pull of the trigger would bring him all the sleep he wanted. In his 5 years as a lawman, he had never shot anyone, though he had a reputation as a dangerous fighter. It would be a joke on everyone if the only person he ever killed was himself. He had always assumed that people who killed themselves were cowards. His own uncle had done it in a painful way, by drinking lye. His uncle had been deep in debt. Now, as he sat and watched the moon, killing himself merely seemed sensible. His life had been ruined. Surprisingly, inexplicably, swiftly, but ruined for sure. He had made wrong choices all along. It had cost 3 lives. Killing himself would put him at one with Roscoe, Janie, and Joe, and the horse. They had started traveling together. It would be fitting that they all ended up in the same place. He began to think about which gun to use, The barrel of the rifle gleamed in the moonlight. The pistol was heavy in his holster. He took out the pistol and slowly turned the cylinder, listening to the heavy clicks. But he didn't put it to his head. He remembered Elmira. It seemed to him that he had to find her, to tell her what had happened to her son. It was true she had never seemed fond of the boy. Elmira had never seemed fond of anyone, but Joe had been her son, and she might want to know. July thought all night. Knowing that he had only to raise the pistol eased his mind a little. He had better go and find Elmira first. He wanted to explain to her that he had never meant to do whatever had caused her to run off. Once that was done, he could go off with the pistol and join his dead. The next morning he started walking, but he didn't feel the same. He felt like he no longer belonged to life. It would not have surprised him to see a cloud of buzzards circling over him. In spirit, he had gone to visit Roscoe. He finished his water that night, having walked all day through the brown, wavy grass. He tried a long shot at a deer, but missed. The next morning, he was awakened by the cawing of crows. He looked up to see several of them flapping overhead in the early grayness. He was tired from his long day's walk and didn't get up immediately. There was nothing to get up for but the bright sun and the shimmering plains. But he kept hearing the crows, cawing and quarreling not far away. When he stood up, he saw a little grove of low trees not 200 yards away. They weren't much, but they were trees, and the crows were resting in them. Among the trees he found a spring, just a trickle of a spring, but it had formed a shallow pool 10 feet wide. A black snake was curled on a rock at the water's edge. It was probably what the crows were complaining about. July spent the day by the spring. He drank, bathed, and soaked his dirty clothes, spreading them out on the grass to dry. While he rested, a big badger walked up to the spring, and July shot him with his pistol. He had never eaten badger, but he ate this one and drank the spring water. Even better than food were the trees. Being in the shade again eased his spirit a little. He could look across the hot prairies for miles from the comfort of his shade. The sun couldn't parch him while he was under the trees, but he couldn't live forever on spring water and one badger. Besides, he had his chore to do. He waited until the cool of the evening and then set out again. The second day he crossed a wagon track coming from the south. It led him to a running creek, but he saw no wagon. The next day he saw a dust cloud, which turned out to be a small cow herd. The cowboys were mighty surprised to see a lone figure walking toward them from the west, and dumbfounded to learn that he was a sheriff from Arkansas. "Did you come from California or where?" the trail boss asked. He was an old white-mustached man named Johns, suspicious at first. Not many men came walking out of Texas. But July soon persuaded the old man to sell him a horse. It was the worst horse in the remuda, but it was a horse. July gave $40 for it. The Johns outfit had no saddle to spare, but they did give him directions. They tried to get him to stay the night with them. They had been on the trail 6 weeks, and a stranger was a welcome novelty. But once he was mounted, July felt a sense of hurry seize him. He ate with him, thanked them again, and left under a rising moon. 4 days later, sore from riding bareback on the little sharp spine bay, he trotted into Dodge City.
Chapter 66.
Long before they struck the Republican River, Elmira had begun to wonder if any of it was worth it. For 2 weeks, when they were on the open plain, it rained, hailed, lightning flashed. Everything she owned was wet, and she didn't like feeling like a muskrat, though it didn't bother Luke and Zway. It was cold at night. She slept on wet blankets in the hard wagon and woke up feeling more tired than when she lay down. The plains turned soggy and the wagon bogged time after time. The hide smelled and the food was chancy. The wagon was rough, even when the going was good. She bounced around all day and felt sick to her stomach. If she lost the baby in such a place, she felt she would probably die. It occurred to her that she had taken a hard route just to escape July Johnson. Her own folly amused her. She had once thought of herself as smart, but look at where she was. If D. Boot could see her, he would laugh his head off. D. loved to laugh about the absurd things people did for bad reasons. The fact that she had done it because she wanted to see him would only amuse him more. D. would tell her she ought to have gone back to